80 years later, remembering a local expert on D-Day, today in the Upper Cumberland. June 6, 1944, the Allied invasion of Normandy in Operation Overlord. We know it better as D-Day, a historic military day, a historic day for world order, an event studied, discussed, and lectured upon by Cumberland County's Bob Emmerich. Bob Emmerich, thank you for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Where did your passion for D-Day begin?
Oh, it began right back when I was a young Boy Scout, about actually Cub Scouts, starting 8, 9 years of age, and that was back in the, a long time ago, the early 50s, late 40s. And basically, most of the leaders around the time, with all the bands and activities going on in the country, were oriented toward wars, Korean and World War II. And our scout leaders were scoutmasters out of World War II and Korean War. And so I developed a great sense of patriotism. And that continued all through my, I was played in a lot of musical groups and marching groups. And I always used to love the patriotic displays and whatever.
What is it about the event that speaks to you?
Well, I think, as I mentioned to you earlier, I love to get interested in history over the last few years, and particularly in great military events and leaders that made a difference, going all the way back to the Roman Empire, even the Greeks. And when we got to the 20th century and current times, I was particularly interested in Winston Churchill and the scope and breadth and the absolute phenomenal leadership that he gave during the war. He basically saved the world, as far as I'm concerned. In fact, Charles Krauthammer, who many people will recognize, thought that Churchill kind of got the short shrift when the leader of the century was named, because that went to Albert Einstein. And with all due respect to Einstein, Krauthammer said, but there was no question in his mind it had to be Winston Churchill. He saved the world. And so from that standpoint, I geared in on Churchill for a bit. And then the key event was D-Day, because that basically saved the world as we know it.
When was your first trip to Normandy?
I think about 1995. I took a tour with an old friend of mine from Michigan, and we started in London, and I forget which group it was, but it was about 12 days. Started in London, went to all the Imperial War Museum, all the sites in London, Churchill's number 10, but the hidden offices below his quarters. And there was a whole under subterranean city down there to protect from the air raids and whatever. And we went down to shipping sites down at Plymouth and whatever, and then ultimately sailed across the sea over into Normandy and spent well over a week there. That was the first trip. And I've been there several times since, culminating in June of 2019, 5 years ago, for the 75th anniversary.
What is it that makes it so emotional, even for those who did not serve there, when you step on that soil?
When you step on the soil is key, because we hit several beaches, Utah and Omaha, which would have been handled by the U.S. And going out on there, there were 50 miles of beaches, and the beaches were at low tide as planned, because the planning group of Operation Overlord, which was the overall campaign, wanted to expose as many of the nasty obstacles and nasty things that Rommel, who was a desert fox of fame, of North African fame, he was protecting that area, defending it, and he wanted to be sure we had to stop that invasion. Everybody knew it was coming. We had to stop that invasion on the shore. And so I think what really struck me was when we went out on the beaches, and at Utah, it was high tide, but by the time we got to Omaha Beach, which was really bloody Omaha, it's a 300-yard stretch. So we talk about three football fields from the edge of the water at low tide up until you actually start getting off the beach. And as you were heading in there, those soldiers You know, they got dropped off in deep water because of the fog of war, what have you. A lot of them drowned or were shot before they even set foot on the beach. Once they got on the beach, it was just all hell broke loose. If anybody who saw Saving Private Ryan, as I understand it, anyone who was there at that time said that's about as close as you're going to get to what went on with the battle without having the stench and the odor and the sound and the blood and gore of what happened. And so that had a very impactful moment. As a matter of fact, I had if this ever comes up, I had a picture of me standing there with my back to the beachhead, and just to say, okay, I'm here. This is Omaha Beach. And when I got home and I started looking at it, I said, boy, that background looks familiar. Because at Omaha Beach, there were about 100-150 feet of cliffs and hills, very rugged terrain. As I'm looking at this picture with me standing in front, I'm looking behind it, and then I happen to see another picture that I had in my representation of the presentations I gave that showed the Higgins boat full of soldiers coming in. And it's a very famous picture. You've seen it this week on the D-Day TV coverage. And with the soldiers getting ready to be dropped off at Higgins. And I looked there, and that place they were heading, I looked at where I was. I said, my God, they were coming right at me. So, and that really struck me. I said, I'm standing where they probably landed. So,
we're talking about D-Day and a local man who has spent his time trying to understand more about the history of that world-changing event. Bob Emmerich is our guest. We continue. We're visiting with Bob Emmerich. What do you think is the biggest misunderstanding as you visit with groups and talk about D-Day? The biggest misunderstanding about D-Day?
Misunderstanding. Well, I think maybe not the biggest misunderstanding, but the biggest misinformation, if you will, was the deception of Operation Overlord. What I particularly focused on in my presentations I gave, I cover the whole thing from soup to nuts, starting back with Hitler's invasion of Poland on September 1st in 1939, up until the end of the war, and then fast forward 75 years later to the celebration. Biggest understanding was the misdirection that the Allies pulled off. Everybody thought, well, Normandy was, you know, that's where they started. Well, it wasn't, because Hitler had Rommel set up the defense, and it stretched all the way from the northern tip of Norway all the way down that coastline. If this thing ever loaded up, I could show you. 2,000 miles down to Spain, which was neutral country. Franco was in charge at that time. And Rommel was responsible for protecting and building the defenses for most of that area. Every one of the military capability knew that there were only a few places where you could really lead a big amphibious invasion that it would have to take, because Hitler was at the peak of his power, and Rommel was defending, and everybody knew it would be probably a bloodbath. There were only two places, and the most likely place was a place called Calais, which is directly across from the cliffs of Dover, which is right at the English Channel, about 22 miles across there. As a matter of fact, that's where people who remember the evacuation of Dunkirk and the slaughter that happened there, that's just down the way from where Dunkirk was. But it was the Pas de Calais. That was the name of the place, and it was a big port and a harbor. So everybody figured, well, it's the shortest distance between two points. It's a great leaping-off point for the Allies, and by then you had Operation Overlord, which has been planned for the invasion, and the aim and goal was to convince Hitler that, in fact, that's where the invasion was going to come, up at Pas de Calais. But Rommel was not so sure, and neither were some of the German generals, because there was another place, which was down on the northern beaches of Normandy, about a 50-mile stretch of five beaches that were perfect for an amphibious landing, a massive amphibious landing. Good beach, good sand on it, good visibility, a very gentle slope to the beaches. But it was five times further away to get there from Plymouth area, about 100 miles across of water across there versus 20 miles up in Calais. So I think the big misconception for everybody who thinks about Normandy, oh, yeah, they went in the D-Day, they went to the beaches of Normandy. Well, but the real ruse was, how do you convince Hitler and his generals that it was coming at the other place and that he basically did his major fortifications up there, much to Rommel's dismay, because Rommel didn't get his reputation as a desert fox easily. He was a smart cookie, the hero of North Africa, and he probably would have beaten the British and Montgomery down there had Hitler supported him with the armaments he needed. Well, he ran into the same problem at Normandy. He kept pleading with Hitler. He says, I'm not so sure about Calais. You better watch the backside down here at Normandy. And he kept pleading with Hitler, but Hitler had the bulk of his panzer, the heavy equipment, the big tanks, the panzer, the German Tigers and whatever, up there at Calais. He had a few down toward Normandy, but he was convinced that it would come up there. And the rest of the story is it came at Normandy, and what amazed me about the whole thing was the behind-the-scenes things that went on in intelligence and breaking the code and so on and setting up a completely fake army. Those were the three legs of the big stool that I think brought about the success of the Normandy invasion.
Bob, explain why an amphibious assault was the way that the Allies thought they had to go, that there wasn't another alternative.
Well, there was no other alternative because Hitler by then had taken over all of Western Europe. And, of course, the Russians were coming in from the Eastern Front. And initially, Hitler and Stalin got along together, but ultimately then Hitler tried to attack Russia and that started the Eastern Front. But prior to then, Hitler had already defended the West along that what they called the Atlantic Wall. Fortress Europe, it was known. And everybody said, you had to come in across the British Channel or some way across the Atlantic, or come in what Churchill thought, well, let's come in through the soft underbelly of Europe, which meant coming in North Africa, crossing the Mediterranean, getting into Malta and Sicily and so on, and coming up through Italy. But that wasn't very practical for marshalling because it was key that the United States, after Pearl Harbor was bombed, and stupidly, one of the most colossal errors of any military leader, like I said, I like to study leadership, made was Hitler, through his hubris, declared war on the U.S. 3 days after Pearl Harbor. That changed the whole thing. Churchill, that was the first night he said he slept the night of babies, because that meant now the U.S. was brought in, the Allies were formed, you had now the world's foremost economic power, the United States, entering the war and helping out England, who stood alone under Churchill through terrible, terrible, terrible threats for virtually from May of 1940 up until, well, for almost a year. So why did they come in through there? Because that was the only way to come in. And England was the closest leap-off point. I know you're talking about moving 150,000 men, 7,000 ships, 13,000 planes, 20,000 vehicles of all kinds, from tanks down to jeeps and trucks and whatever. And you had it was a tremendous source. They had to mount the largest amphibious assault ever in the world, ever. And everybody thought they were going to come across at the same place where William the Conqueror did in 1066, and they were fooled.
Bob Emmerich is our guest as we reflect on D-Day. Bob Emmerich is a D-Day historian. He makes presentations all across the Upper Cumberland, sharing the story of this historic part of not just American history, but world history. And I think probably a lot of people are like me, that you grew up and you learned in history class in high school about D-Day. But it was not until Saving Private Ryan that I knew what a terrible, terrible event this was. I think it kind of gets glossed over maybe in history class that the U.S. and the Allies, we invaded and then we got in and we won the war. But this was a terrible, terrible event.
It was, and it almost didn't succeed, notwithstanding the fact that Hitler was convinced that the invasion and all his generals except Rommel were convinced it was coming at a different place. But Rommel was convinced he could have still repelled the invasion. He says, we have to stop them on the beach. But then, and a matter of fact, Omar Bradley, who had been in charge of the U.S. contingent of the landing force, was ready to call the troops off of Omaha and tell Eisenhower, who was his boss and the head of Operation Overlord, that we failed. Okay, it came that close. Because, when this invasion was planned, there was going to be a parachute, airborne drop, that had to get behind the enemy lines on the western and the eastern flank well before the invasion. So a couple minutes after midnight on June 4th, you had the U.S. 101st and 81st, 2nd Division fly over the western flank of Normandy and be dropped behind the German lines. On the eastern flank, which would have been the left flank of the attack, the British 6th Airborne did the same. They flew in, and their mission was to knock out obstacles and big guns and bridges and roads and cause tremendous chaos and confusion among the German ranks to keep them out of, from counterattacking in the invasion zone. And Rommel and all the German generals, the most important ones, were basically on a holiday. They were down partying in Paris or going to war school games. And Rommel was actually home 100 miles away on his wife's birthday. So everybody was out when the invasion started. The U.S. caught them completely by surprise. But Rommel came back. He marshaled his forces. He kept pleading with Hitler, give us the more panzers down there. And he almost had Hitler convinced. And had he convinced Hitler, they might have repelled the Allies, and that would have been at Omaha. And had Omaha fallen, the rest of the thing would have been like dominoes. It's interesting as to why Hitler wasn't convinced. That's the spy story.
Hmm. Can you put into words what the experience was like for those soldiers getting off those boats?
Well, if anybody watched the documentaries over D-Day, and a matter of fact, I refer people, if not to the movies like Private Ryan and Longest Day, which is a long, long day ago, years ago, YouTube is an excellent source. You just pull up D-Day or soldier stories or whatever, and you will find more than you can ever want. But basically, there were 156,000 Allied troops that were landed on that beach that day.
Now just stop and think about that.
156,000.
Wow.
So that's
UT Stadium and a half.
That's UT Stadium and a half. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And they were basically, I think that the average age was probably about 21 or 22. But there were a lot of kids in there, 18, 19 years of age, because there was a draft in the United States, and the United States was going to provide the bulk of the forces because they were the big guys and they had the most resources and whatever. And the Brits were a little bit more steeled because they had been fighting for 4 years. They had been at Dunkirk. They had been at the Canadians were there, and there was a big disaster and attempted landings before. So the Brits had been hardened and steeled, and they knew what to expect. And so they were battle hardened. Not so with the U.S. Well, the U.S. contingent, the U.S. was hardened in North Africa, where they almost got their pants beat. And anyone who saw the movie on Patton years ago with George C. Scott would know that Patton probably saved the day down there in Tunisia. The soldiers were young. Okay, many of them had never seen combat. They were sailed or flown across the Atlantic, come over to Britain, spend a couple months getting ready and doing the training on scaling cliffs and doing all it was that they had to do, and then D-Day came and they were told that, as a matter of fact, the Admiral Ramsay, I think, of the British Navy, told General Eisenhower, who was his boss. When they were planning, he says, that airborne invasion of dropping those paratroopers and the glider infantry behind the enemy lines, we expect to have 75 to 80% casualties. That's 75 to 80%. And it almost was that on Omaha Beach. Of the 2,500 U.S. troops killed on D-Day, 40% of them were on Omaha Beach, and that was the linchpin. These were kids, and the ones flying over, the pilots of the gliders, the C-47 planes, the Dakotas, they were basically inexperienced. There had never been a drop like this before. With over 900 planes took place. And these planes were not only carrying paratroopers, but they were pulling gliders carrying airborne infantry. And the fog of war for the U.S., and less or so for the British because of a smaller operation, but for the U.S., they came in, and no sooner than they crossed the English Channel, all hell broke loose. Fireworks, the real kind that can knock you out, all the black going on. These pilots are looking at German fighters coming out, buzzing around like mosquitoes. They're seeing their buddies, their fellow planes or gliders being shot down in flames and going down. You can imagine the horror and fear that that puts in your heart when you have, you're being shot at from above, from the planes, from below, with all this flak going off. And there were heavy winds and the fog of war and the confusion and the attempts to dodge and to circumvent it, whatever, just get out of there, drop your load and get the heck out of there. Many of the gliders and planes would drop their packages 5 to 10 miles off course. And that was depicted very well in the Longest Day movie, Lesser and so on, Ryan. But those troops were scattered all over the place, sometimes 5, 10 miles off their course. They had no idea where they were. And it kind of worked out beneficially to a degree, because even though the U.S. troops particularly were scattered all over the place, they couldn't find their units, whatever, the Germans were equally confused, because they didn't know if this was the major invasion, whether it was just a test, you know, a trial or whatever. And the paratroopers had something called on them. They had fake parachutes. They were called Rooper. They were probably little dummies that looked like a parachute or reasonably facsimile when you saw them from a distance. They were about 2.5, 3 feet high, okay? And they're dropped along with these airborne paratroopers, and there are hundreds of them. And, of course, the Germans look up, and they're seeing them coming down. And when these dummies, the Rupers, hit, they were armed with little firecrackers and cherry bombs and all those kinds of things that go off and go boom and bang. And brrr, brrr, and the Germans thought they were under attack, which helped the Allies. And the Germans didn't know what to tell their command bases and their commanders back at their headquarters. We're under attack, but we don't know, because it doesn't appear to be unified. You know, they're just all over the place. One of the worst things that happened, if you talk about striking fear, and so there were a lot of losses. A lot of planes went down, and a lot of the paratroopers and gliders went into nasty obstacles that Rommel set up. Rommel, for example, had opened the floodgates from the sea and flooded a lot of the lowlands. And he put in big telephone poles and whatever, so that would basically catch any gliders coming in. So many gliders came in, they landed in the water, they sunk or they hit these obstacles, and they broke up, and there was a lot of carnage. So it was very scary.
What's the truth about the weather that the Allies?
The weather was the invasion was planned in June, the first week of June. Because it was deemed by the generals, by the Chief Staff being the supreme headquarters of Allied Expeditionary Forces, under the command of General Eisenhower and made up of a coterie of U.S. generals and English and British high-ranking generals. And the weather, they all agreed that the ideal conditions for the tides, for the currents, for the weather, for the sea conditions and whatever, would be the first week in June. And it was therefore planned as the June 5th. But on June 5th, all the landing troops were already on their ships in harbor. And a lot of them are getting seasick. They're just bouncing around, you know, and it was hard. Eisenhower was really concerned about this, because we can't put that invasion off. But his weather people kept coming in, so we have some terrible weather coming in. They could tell from what they were receiving from the British Navy out on the Atlantic, because that's where the weather came from. And they said, there's some nasty, and the English Channel can get very, very treacherous, terrible, terrible sailing condition. And so Eisenhower very reluctantly said we're going to have to defer it to the 6th. And he was really uptight, as were all the staff, because they if we can't do it on the 6th, we're going to have to wait for ideal conditions for another 2 or 3 weeks and also the moon's position, so on. And by then, the Germans will know we're here because we can't hide this whole colossal thing off the coast of England for much longer. The Germans, you know, our fighters, the Spitfires and Hurricanes or whatever, trying to keep the German aerial reconnaissance away, but you can only do that so long. And so that was the problem. The weather was a great problem, and it turned out by probably, some would say, the stroke of the Almighty. Because on the about the afternoon of June 5th, which was supposed to be the day, and they're watching this thing minute by minute, and all the troops are out there lined up. Everybody's and you can imagine the forces. They know they're going in this great thing. They don't know where they're going. But as the buildup comes, you can imagine the nerves and what's going on, churning in the bellies. And, of course, they're doing all kinds of things to try to keep preoccupied, including gambling, and you know. But they can't be – they're not at liberty now. They're on these ships, and they're floating around, you know. And finally, Captain Stang, it was, I think, the head of the meteorological group at Operation Overlord, which was headquartered in a place called – think of it now. It was a place down by an old estate down by Plymouth, right outside of there, where Eisenhower could go and visit, and Southwick House it was, and all of them gathered. As a matter of fact, when we went on the tour, we were able to go in Southwick House and actually go into the war room, which had the big map where everyone gathered to watch the thing take off. So shortly. Earlier that day, Captain Stang came in, and even though the weather was terrible out at that time, he says, "We have a break coming. We have a break coming. It's not going to last long. It may not last for more than 12, 18 hours." And he laid that on Eisenhower, and Eisenhower fretted over that, and he looked at all. He had a meeting sitting around this kidney-shaped table. He says, "Bradley, what do you think? Go. Montgomery, what do you think? I say go." Talk to the air commanders. They said, "Well, we're not so sure. You know, you're going to have 75-80% casualties, you know, just getting in there. And if we can't get the air, the troopers in there behind the line to knock out those German armaments before we set the amphibious operation, we'll be killed because the Germans have submarines out there. They have planes going overhead. They have all the artillery coming in from the shore. It'll be a disaster." So finally, Eisenhower surveyed all his guys and got a consensus. He said, "Okay, we go." And then all the wheels were set into action. And Eisenhower at that point, and there's a famous newsreel, probably shown this past D-Day, it's shown all the time, of Eisenhower going down to one of the airfields outside of Plymouth, which is where Lord Nelson had all his things. He had his old ship is down there today, the Victory. Went down to Plymouth, and he visited contingent of the 101st Airborne. And there they all there are in their packs, stacked up against their C-47s, ready to board. And being a farm boy from Kansas, he sought out a soldier from Kansas. And so he goes over and meets him. Of course, all the troopers come out in that area and gather around him. And Eisenhower's there and said, "Where are you from, son?" "I went to Kansas." So they had a little discussion going on. And there are famous pictures and newsreels taken of this. No one knew at the time, though, that Eisenhower had in his lapel, in his jacket's pocket, a piece of paper that was going to be released if the invasion failed. And he said, and he basically said, that "It was my decision. It didn't work out, and that's where we are." Okay, and it was very, very sobering. And he knew that. He knew that he was sending these airborne troopers. He said, 7 or 8 out of every 10 I'm talking to you will probably not make it. So that was high drama.
Bob Emmerich is our guest. In our closing moments with Bob Emmerich as we remember D-Day, and maybe it's because of the work that I do every day, but I'm always fascinated when you talk about D-Day that unlike today where all of this would be on live television, nobody knew.
That's right.
And it would be hours.
That's right.
Before those in the United States, and there's the famous speech that the president made, that FDR made, that we're sending our boys, and it was to improvise it. Basically, we're going to see what happens.
Well, I don't know how much time you have, but there's another part of that story. The invasion started at 6:30 on June 6th. That's when the amphibious started. The airborne were already out behind causing their chaos. Now, there was a spy known as the Spy Who Saved the World. That's another story into itself. A guy by the name of Juan Pujol. He was a double agent that the British turned, okay? And he, all through the time, I said that it was key to convince Hitler that the invasion was coming to come. He had developed a set of 27 network spies, all of whom were figments of his imagination. And he had been a German spy before because he needed to get credibility with the Brits. I mean, the story is incredible. But he becomes a spy for the Germans, gets success. The British are picking him up through the codes. And he finally goes back to the British and says, will you take me now? Because they had turned him down before. He said, well, welcome, Alaric. And Alaric, by the way, was his code name with the Germans. And Alaric, for anyone who knows Germanic history and Roman history, Alaric was the barbarian warlord who raided and sacked Rome. So they thought a lot of Alaric. Alaric goes over to MI5, the British the counterpart of the FI, says, hi, will you take me now? They says, welcome. He becomes a spy, a master of disguise, his fake 27 spy networks. And he could hobnob, impersonate with anybody, spoke five languages. And he was so good that his British MI5 handler gave him the code name Garbo, named after the most famous actor in the world, Greta Garbo. Now, Garbo, a.k.a. Alaric to the Germans, is sending all this chicken feed stuff to the Germans through his British handlers. Chicken feed meaning it's true stuff, but it's not enough to do any damage. So he has the Germans get out of his hand by the time D-Day comes. And so much so that Hitler said, what does Alaric say as the Germans are getting? Because Alaric or Garbo would castigate his German counterpart. He said, you guys aren't listening to him. I'm out of here. No, don't. Because he would make big epistles, all full of detail, all from these 27 agents. So he says, don't be fooled. That invasion's coming up at Calais. So the invasion came at Normandy. But even when the invasion started at 6 in the morning, the Germans weren't sure. Rommel was sure, but not Hitler. And 9 o'clock, 3 hours after the invasion started, 9 o'clock in the morning, it looked as if this was a real thing. And so Rommel was then beginning to convince Hitler, let those Panzers get down here. Had Hitler acceded then, he could have stopped the invasion, okay? But Alaric, just at that very time, sent purposely 3 hours late to the Germans saying, I'm told by three of my top agents, don't be fooled. That's still coming up at Calais. This is a ruse. And so Rommel was denied by Hitler. That was 3 days after. 3 days later, the same thing happened because now Hitler is going, this is a real thing, okay? And Rommel throwing his hands up. Alaric sends another message saying, I know you guys are getting serious about, Hitler bought a hook, line, and sinker, and there was one documentary said this Hitler believed the real invasion was still coming to Calais into August. And as a result, Alaric became a hero to both sides. The Germans thought so much of him because he was giving them all this information, what they believed. They gave him the highest-ranking citizen award, the German Cross, the Knight's Cross, and the British gave him the Order of the British Empire. And there's a picture in one of the documentaries showing him saying, the spy who saved the world.
It's unbelievable. It's an unbelievable history that Bob Emmerich has shared with the Upper Cumberland, and he continues to share his memories of D-Day. Thank you for sharing with us today.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's been my pleasure.
That is fabulous.